From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now.
I'm going to start until Mr. Burr leaves the stage. Would the police officer please ask Mr. Burr to leave the stage?
Why can't he talk?
We want to hear what he's got to say.
One stormed the stage, another was arrested. Their crimes, they're Green Party candidates trying to participate in the political debate.
My name's Howie Hawkins. I'm the Green Party candidate for U.S. Senate in New York State. And I was recently excluded from the only two senatorial debates in New York State.
Today, Howie Hawkins of New York, Delaware congressional candidate Michael Berg, Washington senatorial candidate Aaron Dixon, and the League of Women Voters. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The top American military leader in Iraq says more U.S. troops may be headed to war. Speaking in Baghdad Tuesday, General George Casey said the U.S. has set a new target to hand security control to the Iraqi government for no sooner than the end of next year. General Casey said he believes Iraq will see significant progress by that time, but indicated that will require more U.S. troops. He also blamed Iran and Syria for the ongoing violence.
And both Iran and Syria continue to be decidedly unhelpful by providing support to the different extremists and terrorist groups operating inside Iraq. Now, if you add to all this the intensities of Ramadan and the fact that the new government is about 150 days old, it makes for a difficult situation, and it's likely to remain that way over the near term.
General Casey spoke alongside U.S. Ambassador Zalmay Khalilzad.
All right. Straightforward. Despite the difficult challenges we face, success in Iraq is possible and can be achieved on a realistic timetable. Iraqi leaders must step up to achieve key political and security milestones on which they have agreed.
For several minutes, Casey and Khalilzad were forced to speak in the dark following a power outage in the U.S.-controlled Green Zone. As the Bush administration weighs sending more troops, the British military may be setting a timetable to withdraw its forces within a year. A U.S. defense official has told the Reuters news agency Britain's complaining its troops are, quote, near the breaking point in Iraq. A new poll released Tuesday shows withdrawal enjoys wide support among British citizens, with 60% in favor of a pullout this year. Meanwhile, more than 100 active-duty service members have now signed an appeal formally asking Congress to end the U.S. occupation of Iraq. The appeal was launched this week on the website appealforredress.org. It says, quote, "As a patriotic American proud to serve the nation in uniform, I respectfully urge my political leaders in Congress to support the prompt withdrawal of all American military forces and bases from Iraq. Staying in Iraq will not work and is not worth the price. It's time for U.S. troops to come home." In other Iraq news, an overnight U.S. airstrike has killed at least five people and injured six others in the Sadr City district of Baghdad. The U.S. says it launched the attacks after Iraqi troops came under fire. The Iraqi Interior Ministry says another 20 Iraqis were injured in the U.S. raid. Also Tuesday, the Pentagon announced the deaths of four U.S. troops. 91 service members have now lost their lives in Iraq this month. Meanwhile, the U.S. military is apologizing for what it calls the accidental killing of four Iraqi firefighters. The firefighters were responding to a call Monday when they were pulled over by U.S. troops. The Pentagon says the troops opened fire after mistaking the unarmed firefighters for insurgents. Venezuela is denying that it's giving up its bid to join the U.N. Security Council and asked Bolivia to run in its place. The denial came after Bolivian President Evo Morales made this announcement Tuesday.
Comandante Chavez told me that as they have not been able to attain a two-thirds majority for the Security Council, our friend Hugo Chavez said to gain consensus, he would give the candidacy to Bolivia.
The Venezuelan Foreign Ministry says it's raised the possibility of Bolivia's candidacy, but has not made a final decision. Guatemala currently leads Venezuela, but has not received the required two-thirds majority vote at the General Assembly. In other news from the UN, Cuba's renewing calls for an end to the U.S. embargo ahead of an upcoming vote at the General Assembly. This is Dagoberto Rodriguez Pereira, chief of the Cuban Interest Section in Washington.
The U.S. blockade has caused the Cuban people immense suffering and not only violates their fundamental human rights, but also the rights of Cubans who live in the U.S., the people of the United States, and citizens in third countries.
The U.N. General Assembly holds its annual vote on the embargo 2 weeks from today. In Afghanistan, a young girl was killed and two other children injured in a NATO bombing in the eastern Kunar province Tuesday. A NATO spokesperson says its forces were aiming at insurgents. In the occupied territories, a Spanish photographer with the Associated Press was freed Tuesday after less than a day in captivity. The photographer, Emilio Marinatti, had been kidnapped by masked assailants outside his apartment earlier in the day. In environmental news, the World Wildlife Fund is warning humans will be in need of two planets' worth of natural resources by the year 2050 unless consumption undergoes a radical change. The group says human reliance on the environment is now 25% greater than the planet can provide each year. Here in the United States, a new report from the monitor group electionline.org is warning 10 states are at risk of major voting problems in next month's midterm elections. The report says balloting could be complicated by a combination of uncertain voting machine technology and confusion over procedures. The report concludes, quote, "The November 7th election promises to bring more of what voters have come to expect since the 2000 elections, a divided body politic, an election system in flux, and the possibility, if not certainty, of problems at polls nationwide." Meanwhile, another report says these elections will mark the most expensive congressional race in U.S. history. According to the Center for Responsive Politics, candidates, parties, and advocacy groups will spend $2.6 billion on races across the country. Three-quarters of the total spending will come from business groups. In education news, the Bush administration has announced new rules that will allow school districts to create more single-sex classrooms and schools. The new rules alter existing regulations that bar sex discrimination in education programs or activities that receive federal funding. The American Civil Liberties Union and the National Organization for Women are both opposing the rule change. And finally, this news from Louisiana. New figures show a major racial disparity in the payment of insurance claims to victims of Hurricane Katrina. According to the Associated Press, white residents of New Orleans and surrounding parishes have been three times as likely as minority residents to request and receive help from agencies in disputes with insurance companies. Government figures show close to 75% of settled claims were filed by residents living in predominantly white neighborhoods. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Today, we continue our coverage of the midterm elections. The League of Women Voters has withdrawn its sponsorship of three debates in New York because Green Party candidates were excluded from participation. Two of those debates were between candidates running for attorney general. The Democratic candidate is Andrew Cuomo. The Republican is Jeanine Pirro. Rachel Trichler is the Green Party candidate. Sources from the two stations sponsoring the debates told Metroland, an alternative weekly in Albany, that it was Cuomo's camp which refused to participate in the debates if Trichler were to be included. The League also withdrew its sponsorship of a debate between Democratic Senator Hillary Clinton and Republican challenger John Spencer after Green Party candidate Howie Hawkins was excluded. In a press release announcing their decision, the League stated they determined that the Republican, Democrat, and Green candidates were all bona fide contestants and should have all been included in the debates. Today, we'll talk about Green Party politics and how third-party candidates are being blocked from taking part in debates. Howie Hawkins joins us here in Democracy Now! Studios. And from Albany, we're joined by Betsy Swan. She's the legislative analyst with the League of Women Voters New York State. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Howie Hawkins, why don't you begin? Tell us how the process works, how the debates are set up.
Well, you have groups like the League of Women Voters that try to participate,
What I heard from them is that they were negotiating with their corporate sponsors, which would be the corporate broadcast media. And I would assume the corporate sponsor candidates, particularly Hillary Clinton. My hunch is the broadcast media felt she's the show, and if she won't show, it's not worth doing the show for the broadcast media. So I don't have direct confirmation that she did the same thing Cuomo did, but that's my hunch. That's been my experience in running for local races and trying to get in debates in Syracuse.
Betsy Swann, why don't you lay out for us what these negotiations were? How was the League of Women Voters involved?
Well, the League has a policy that we apply in determining what candidates we will invite to participate in our debates. The policy was last modified in 1992. The Board of Directors invites third-party candidates to submit materials and information about their candidacies to the State League. The board reviews these materials and makes a determination about whether a candidate is a bona fide contestant. Among the standards that the League employs are the candidate's constitutional eligibility to run for office, ballot access, compliance with financial filing requirements, and demonstration of significant voter interest and support in the candidacy. And the things we look at are evidence of a formal statewide campaign with the presence of headquarters, issuance of position papers, campaign appearances, fundraising activities. And then we look at other factors that provides substantive evidence of voter interest. And this can include serious media attention or results in polls. And the Board of Directors looked at these criteria and determined that the two Green Party candidates, Howie Hawkins and Rachel Trichler, did meet these criteria and therefore had to be invited to participate in any League-sponsored debates.
And so what happened?
Well, once the decision was made, we were in negotiations for one debate with WXXI in Rochester. This was a debate for the Attorney General's office.
And WXXI is owned by?
It's a PBS station in Rochester.
Uh-huh.
And then two debates out of New York City with WABC, one for the U.S. Senate and one for the state attorney general's race. Basically, we were negotiating, and the bottom line with XXI was we were told that if Rachel Trichler participated, Andrew Cuomo would not, and they were going with the debate with the two main party candidates. At that point, because the League takes a position that once it has determined a candidate is a bona fide contestant, the candidate is required to be invited to debate for League sponsorship, we had no choice but to withdraw. A similar situation occurred in New York City. We don't know the reason that the debates were limited to the two main candidates, but we were unable to negotiate inclusion of the Green Party candidates and also had to withdraw from those debates.
What is the League of Women Voters' history when it comes to debates? How have you been involved? How did it all start?
Well, it's a long history, and it precedes me by many years. I can talk in general terms about why the League organizes debates and how we organize them. The League's a nonpartisan political organization. It was formed to encourage active and informed citizen participation in government. And one of our major focuses is voter services activity. To that end, we publish Voters Guide, and we run candidate debates at all levels, at the national level, the state level, and local levels. And we employ pretty much the same procedure at all levels. We adopt standards that we will use to judge whether candidates will be asked to debate And once we have determined that a candidate is eligible, we require that the candidate be invited in order for the league to sponsor debates. We feel very strongly that the public has a right to know, to hear from viable candidates, and we also feel very strongly that the process should not be dictated by the political strategy of front runners, which is why we have adopted our position.
So is the League of Women Voters just being increasingly sidelined because you take this nonpartisan view and you insist on viable candidates being able to participate? You're just getting taken out of all of these discussions.
I would say we are not getting taken out. We certainly have sponsored a number of debates this year, and at the local level, we have ongoing and very frequent sponsorship of debates. I think it's an ongoing dilemma and not one that is peculiar to the league. There are many organizations, some traditional news organizations, some organizations such as the League, that feel it's very important that the public hear from a range of candidates. I think we all take slightly different tacks in how we approach this. I think the important thing is that the discussion continues and that we have as many debates as we can with as many viable candidates talking as we can.
Are we now having corporations taking over the decision-making about who will participate? For example, we had Jonathan Tessini on. Now, he was a Democratic candidate before the Democratic primary challenging Hillary Rodham Clinton, and it was New York One, whose parent is Time Warner, that said that he had to have a something like a minimum 5% polling and $500,000 in the bank. He had over 13% polling, but he didn't have that money in the bank. It wasn't either or, it was both. And it turned out that the parent company, Time Warner, had given Hillary Rodham Clinton something like $100,000. Ultimately, they didn't hold the debate. Betsy Swann.
That happens. Those standards are very different from the league standards. We do look at polling. We have disjunctive requirements, so if the poll figures are not met, there are other ways a candidate can prove viability of candidacy.
But in this case, he was more than double the polling. The polling wasn't the issue at all.
Yes.
It was this prohibitive amount of money in the bank that I think was more than you needed as a presidential candidate he was running for.
Obviously, those are standards that the league has not seen fit to adopt. We don't feel they're appropriate to use that type of standard to exclude candidates.
Well, Betsy Swann, I want to thank you very much for joining us, legislative analyst for the League of Women Voters, New York State. Thank you, speaking to us from Albany. Howie Hawkins, you're the person that they pulled out their sponsorship over here in New York. Talk about your attempts. I mean, what message it is you're trying to get out and how you do get it out when you're not able to participate in the debate.
Well, the debate would have been great because the two leading issues I'm running on are bringing the troops home from Iraq, and we know that a 2-to-1 majority of New Yorkers are for that position. And the other position is a national health insurance program that would cover everybody, and we know 3-to-1 New Yorkers favor that. So it wasn't just my personal disappointment. It was the disservice to the majority of New Yorkers who did not have a voice in these debates. Clinton and Spencer, the Democrat and Republican, debated how to fight the war in Iraq, not to get out of it, and how to patch up private health insurance. So the majority of New Yorkers were, in a sense, excluded from these debates. My experience is the leading candidates basically dictate the terms, and the broadcast media won't broadcast debates without the leading personalities. And in this case, Clinton is, you know, the best-funded, probably best-known candidate in the whole country. So in my sense is she dictated the terms. I personally experienced that when I've negotiated over mayoral debates. I ran for mayor of Syracuse last year, And, you know, the Democrat came in and said, we're doing one debate with this one particular station, not three like he originally agreed to. And then the Republican negotiator said, well, if the Democratic mayor doesn't show up, we're not showing up. My position was, I'll show up and debate anybody, anytime. And I believe the producers sympathized with my position. But in the end, they made a business decision. And so
that's... What do you mean, a business decision?
They said they won't get an audience if the mayor isn't involved. So the mayor was basically able to dictate the terms. A mayor who had, you know, $1 million to run for mayor of Syracuse, a city now of about $125,000.
We're talking to Howie Hawkins, Green candidate for U.S. Senate in New York. And when we come back from break, he'll be joined by the Green Party candidate for Congress from Delaware. He lost his son in Iraq. His son was beheaded there. Our guest is Michael Berg. He'll join us from Delaware. Stay with us.
Rastafari, live and ever die. Yo, then I want to fight for. What am I going to fight for? I fire a light, you know. Oh, you better off. Show love, cause there is hope, yeah. Hey, do not fight. No, you can work it out, yeah. We don't need no war. Doesn't know how to live, much less how they survive. Some vindictive feelings, some dirty vibes, causing you to be moving like scribes. You got a personal thing within yourself. That's what you do. You kill others and sin yourself. Your dirty words cause you to perish yourself. Learn and bless yourself, oh, you're better off. So love and there is hope, yeah. And do not fight. I know you can work things out.
Sizzla here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we turn to Delaware in the race for the state's one House seat, three challengers are vying to upset seven-term incumbent Republican Congressmember Mike Castle. Democratic candidate Dennis Spivak is up against Karen Hartley Nagel, who's running as an independent, and Michael Byrd, who's on the Green Party ticket. Michael Berg is the father of Nicholas Berg, the 26-year-old American who was captured and beheaded in Iraq in May 2004. Last week, a forum for the candidates was held at Brandywine High School in Wilmington, Delaware. The forum was sponsored by the Council of Civic Organizations of Brandywine 100. Third-party candidates were not invited. Well, Michael Berg decided to attend the forum anyway. He climbed onto the stage and took a seat. Forum moderator Harvey Rubenstein asked him to leave.
I'm asking you, Mr. Berg, to please leave the stage. If you want to, make a spectacle of yourself, I understand that, but we're ready to start.
I think you're making a spectacle of democracy.
Michael Berg was then escorted from the forum by a police officer. According to the Delaware News Journal, Rubenstein told the audience afterwards the third party and independent candidates were not invited because, quote, voters have traditionally stuck with the Republican and Democratic parties. He also said that including all candidates would have meant stretching the forum out for 3 or 4 hours. Michael Berg joins us now from studio in Delaware. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Michael Berg.
Thank you.
It's good to have you with us. Well, why don't you further describe the scene? And for our radio listeners, you can go to our website and see the video of Michael Berg sitting on the stage and then being escorted out. Describe what happened.
Well, they did let Karen Hartley Nagel and I come in and set up a display of campaign materials. All the other candidates got a whole table. They made us share a table. It kind of dominionizes us and makes us look small. Then people finally started filing into the auditorium, and I just decided that that I was going to go up on the stage and sit down with them. So I did. Mr. Rubenstein asked me to leave, and I just tried to bring it to the attention of the people in the audience that they were being deprived of hearing all four candidates. Mr. Rubenstein's comment in the paper that having all of the candidates participate would have stretched it out to 3 or 4 hours was very misleading. There were only three candidates who were being deprived of being heard when their opponents were being heard. There were a whole list of other candidates where no one in the office was being allowed to talk. That's a different story. If the Democrat can't talk, the Republican can't talk, the Green and the Independent can't talk, that puts everyone on an even level. But when you say the Democrat can talk and the Republican can talk, but the Green and the Independent can't, that to me is vote steering.
So what did you, as I look at the video, you put tape over your mouth?
That wasn't tape. That was actually a bumper sticker that said Berg for Congress. I had done that before at the Jewish Community Center. And I just wanted people to realize that not only was I being gagged, but they were being prevented from hearing all of the candidates.
Well, your response to Mr. Rubenstein telling the audience that third party and independent candidates were not invited because voters have traditionally stuck with the Republican and Democratic parties.
Well, you know, it's kind of a catch-22. What they say is that there isn't enough voter interest in us, but they won't let the voters see us so that they can become interested in us. The whole thing is set up and run by Democrats and Republicans, and it keeps us out. Mike Castle had earlier indicated he's the Republican incumbent. He had earlier indicated that he thought that all candidates should be allowed to speak, and there was some possibility that he wasn't going to go to any forum where they wouldn't allow us to speak. But tonight he will debate Dennis Spivak, the Democrat, and Karen Hartley-Nagel and I will be barred from it.
Why are you running for Congress, Michael Berg?
I'm running for Congress to stop the war that stopped my son, Nick. None of the other candidates, not even the independent Karen Hartley-Nagel, is willing to say, if elected, I will support, vote for, and sponsor bills to end the war immediately. People want to let the war go on for 3 months or 6 months, but every 3 minutes, someone is dying. That's according to the latest Johns Hopkins study. That's too many for me. My son Nick was killed the 91st day that he was in Iraq, and people want to let the war go on 90 more days. Nick was abducted the 58th day, and his fate was sealed that he was in Iraq. And people want to let the war go on for another 3 months, another 6 months, or indefinitely, as the Republican says. I don't see how people feel that they have the authority to allow people to die at the rate of one every 3 minutes. I don't.
Michael Berg, I remember when we talked to you about your son, when he was beheaded. Before that, he was held in U.S. captivity, and you were investigating what happened. For people who don't remember, if you could explain, and are you continuing that investigation as you run for Congress from Delaware?
Well, what happened to my son was he was picked up by the Iraqi police, who immediately turned him over to the American military police, who immediately turned him over to the FBI. He was held in an American military prison illegally for 13 days. And finally, I filed a writ of habeas corpus, which I guess I can't do anymore, and got him out of that American prison. But it was too late. The events that took place at the Abu Ghraib prison, the rapes, murders, and tortures became public, and the resistance to the American invasion of Iraq became a grassroots affair in Iraq. Everyone became against the Americans, and so Nick was abducted shortly thereafter. I blame the United States military and the FBI for detaining Nick illegally for 13 days and preventing him from going home when he had planned to go home, which was before those atrocities were made public, and he would have been home safely. As far as the investigation is concerned, I got to ask questions of the Defense Department, the State Department, the military, the FBI, But as far as I'm concerned, I got the same lies that they told the public. So now I haven't furthered the investigation beyond that. I don't think I will ever get the honest truth, certainly not with the current administration in power.
He was head of a telecommunications company. He wanted to help set up telecommunications in Iraq.
That's right. It was originally about a year before he went over. It was just a one-man company. But by the time he went over to Iraq, he had about a half a dozen people working for him. To say that he was the head of a telecommunications company sounds like more than what it was. He originally used a corner of my garage and our spare bedroom as his warehouse and office.
And the U.S. held him. Why? He was a contractor.
Well, they held him, they said, because they were suspicious of an American who wasn't with Bechtel's or Halliburton or the U.S. military. Nick was there legally. He had all the proper visas and papers. He was actually recruited to go there at a forum in Crystal City, Virginia, on December the 4th of 2003, which was part of Michael Moore's Fahrenheit 911 movie. But they were suspicious of him. They didn't think that Americans should be walking around alone. And that's there was no policy about that. That was just one person's opinion. So they arrested him. They took him to the American military police. And there, a lawyer, Lieutenant Colonel William Kern, decided all on his own that was true, that it was suspicious for an American to be alone. Nick hadn't done anything. Nick is to this day not suspected at this time of ever having done anything wrong. And every agency that I posed that question to told me that was true, that he's not suspected of having done anything wrong. He was at the time, they were worried that he was a terrorist. So they took their time investigating and finally concluded that he wasn't a terrorist and they let him go. But it was too late for him when they did it.
So why are you running for Congress?
Well, I can't do anything about my son's death at this point. Nothing will ever bring him back. But I am running for Congress in the same way that a parent who loses a child in a bicycle accident when they didn't have a helmet on, you know, and then they go out on a crusade to try to get everyone to put helmets on their children when they ride their bicycles. It's the same thing with me. This war, this stupid war that was based on lies to begin with, that is going on just for George Bush to save face, which is backfiring anyhow, is killing people at the rate of one every 3 minutes. Someone is having the experience that I had every 3 minutes. Someone is losing a son. Someone is losing a father. Someone is losing a loved one every 3 minutes in Iraq, and I'm running for Congress to stop it.
We're also joined, Michael Berg, by Howie Hawkins, who is the New York Green senatorial candidate. Howie, you come from Rochester?
Syracuse.
Explain how you got involved in politics. What is your background?
I came up in the San Francisco Bay Area, and by the time I was about 12 years old, 1964, Reagan's campaigning against fair housing, I decided I'm not a Republican. And then I watched the Democrats exclude the Mississippi Freedom Democrats. And at that point, I said, I'm looking for my own party, which became the Peace and Freedom Campaign in 1967-68. I'm 14 years old then, urging adults to register in this party. I was afraid of getting drafted. I eventually was drafted. And since that time, I've been involved in trying to set up a people's party that wasn't corporate funded, that tried to represent the working people in this country, fights for peace, fights for the environment. And so I, you know, just sort of got involved at that time and have stuck with it.
And why did you choose this race, the senatorial race?
It kind of chose me. The state committee asked me to run. And we knew we were going to run somebody because Clinton's been pro-war, and the war issue is, you know, Michael's just been very articulate about that. It's not only a personal tragedy for all the people being affected, military families, and a lot of people are tied to the military through their family, but it's draining our treasury. It's bankrupting our country. Over $1 trillion, according to former Clinton administration officials who, you know, Joseph Stiglitz and Linda Bilmes, who studied the cost of what the troops coming back home are going to be sick, disabled. The depleted uranium is causing what we call Gulf War syndrome from the first Gulf War. And now we're finding out the proportions are the same. Hundreds of thousands of people coming back are going to have to be taken care of over the long run. So that's going to drain our treasury. So, you know, this is a central issue. And so we knew we wanted to run against Clinton and whoever the Republicans put up because we needed an anti-war alternative. And then there are lots of other issues. I mentioned health care, the energy crisis, the problem of global warming. You know, my position is take about half the military budget, $300 billion a year, and over 10 years build a new energy infrastructure for the world around renewable energy. I believe that will create hundreds of thousands of jobs in New York alone. It will do more for world peace and national security than all the arms in the world. And it will deal with this problem of global warming.
So how do you get word out? You're not included in the televised
right.
debates.
It's
how
going
are you
out,
conducting your campaign?
It's going out by word of mouth through organized groups like the peace movement, community groups. Zogby did a poll, showed I'm getting 21% support among independent voters. And you look at party enrollment in New York State, that's at least 5% of the total vote. If I got that vote, it'd be the most a Green ever got in the state, more than Nader got in 2000. It'd be more than an independent progressive for Senate got in New York State since W.E.B. Du Bois in 1950. He got 210,000 votes. The kind of numbers I'm getting translate into 300,000 to 400,000 votes. If we hold that, it will send a strong message on our issues and I think give hope to the movements who I think have been demoralized. You look at the anti-war sentiment using the Gallup poll question, was the war a mistake? And in 3 years, we've got to just about where we were in the anti-Vietnam War. We're at 54% on that question. It was 56 at the peak of the anti-war Vietnam War. But you don't see the manifestation in the resistance and in the movement. So I think a strong vote for us will give hope to the movements and encourage all kinds of activity on the issues we're talking about.
You're not dealing with a close race here in New York, but I wanted to talk about one of the places where there is a close race, turning to Pennsylvania, where newly released campaign finance documents have revealed the state's Green Party has been receiving money from a most unlikely source, the founder and owner of the mercenary company Blackwater USA. Federal Election Commission filings show that Eric Prince and his wife donated $10,000 to a chapter of the Green Party in Pennsylvania. Other prominent Republicans who donated to the Green Party chapter included a Halliburton lobbyist, a former aide of Senator Majority Leader Bill Frist, and California's leading anti-choice activist. The Republicans were trying to help get the Green Party's Senate candidate, Carl Romanelli, on the ballot in an attempt to take away votes from Democrat Bob Casey in an extremely close race he has against Republican Senator Rick Santorum. Will Bunch of Philadelphia Daily News helped break the story on his blog. He joins us now from Philadelphia. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Will Bunch.
Yeah, hi, Amy. Thanks for having me on the show.
Your blog, Attitude, A-T-T-Y-T-O-O-D.
Thanks for the help. Yeah, that's what it is.
Well, explain exactly what you found, and then I would like to get these Green Party candidates, though not in Pennsylvania, Howie Hawkins here running in New York, and Michael Berg in Delaware.
Sure, and I understand they had nothing to do with what's going on here in Pennsylvania, but what is going on here in Pennsylvania is kind of fascinating. You had a situation where, first of all, just by way of background, Pennsylvania has a very onerous and very restrictive ballot access procedure. And I think most people, no matter what their politics, look at that, are not happy about that. I mean, we obviously would like to see a situation where, you know, it's easier for third-party candidates and people with alternative viewpoints to get on the ballot. The way it works in Pennsylvania is you need a large number of signatures from all over the state to qualify for the ballot. In fact, it's a formula, but they figured you needed 70,000 signatures across the state, valid signatures from registered voters to qualify, and that's a lot. In fact, it takes as much as $100,000 to do that. The Green Party of Pennsylvania obviously doesn't have $100,000, but lo and behold, they got $100,000, and the way they did that was through an effort that was totally 100%, not even 99%, but 100% funded by conservatives and Republicans, most of whom either have a history of directly supporting Rick Santorum, the Republican candidate in the Senate race here in Pennsylvania, or supporting causes that are close to Rick Santorum, either you know, opposing abortion rights or that sort of thing. You know, so we have a situation here where, and as it turned out, even in spite of all of that, and in spite of spending $100,000 on a company that with Republican roots that's very controversial that helped them try to get on the ballot. In the end, they still didn't have enough signatures. And in fact, Carl Romanelli, barring a last minute, he may have one appeal still out there, but I'm 99.9% sure Carl Romanelli will not be on the ballot next month. It's kind of disturbing. I mean, voters want choice here, but I mean, clearly the entire Green Party candidacy here ended up being a motivator to get liberal voters. As some of your listeners may know, that the Democratic candidate we have here in Pennsylvania, Bob Casey, is one of the more conservative Democrats out there. He's anti-abortion. He supports some NRA positions, that sort of thing. And, you know, some progressive voters would want to go for somebody with the Green Party if there was a legitimate Green Party candidate. This was not a legitimate campaign by any means. This was an attempt to divert votes from Bob Casey and help one of the most conservative Republicans in the country, Rick Santorum, get reelected.
And how exactly did you go about investigating this?
It wasn't that hard. I mean, thankfully, you know, Federal Election Commission reports go online fairly quickly after they're filed. And some other sites, I know TPM Muckraker, which is a very good political site, and also I think some journalists from the Philadelphia Inquirer and some of the other papers around the state did get, I think, the initial tip that it wasn't even either the Romanelli campaign or the Green Party of Pennsylvania that was accepting these donations. It was a committee that was set up called the Green Party of Luzerne County. Luzerne County is a county in Pennsylvania where Scranton, Wilkes-Barre, which is where Romanelli is from, is located. So it's not the type of committee that people would normally, the most political reporters would most normally not look at the records of the Green Party of Luzerne County, Pennsylvania, in their normal duties. You know, luckily somebody stumbled onto this, and when people looked into it, they found out that this group has raised well over $100,000 now, all of it from Republican and conservative donors, and it's all gone. It all went to fund trying to get Carl Romanelli on the ballot, either through signature gathering or then later on legal fees to try and keep him on the ballot.
And this company, JSM, the Republican-oriented ballot access firm?
Right. So, I mean, some of your listeners who follow these things may be familiar with some of the weird doings that happened in the 2004 election with people on college campuses signing petitions that they thought were, like, for medical marijuana and issues like that. And then finding out that they'd been registered as a Republican, even though they were not Republicans. JSM was a company that was involved in not all of that, but a lot of that type of shenanigans that went on in 2004. And they also did a lot of work trying to pull essentially the same tactic in terms of trying to get Ralph Nader on the ballot in different states, including, I believe, here in Pennsylvania. You know, with the same principle that Nader would have taken votes away from Kerry and help Bush win the election.
And the comments of Mr. Romanelli, you're saying that he wasn't even receiving the money. He might not have even known about it.
Yeah, to be honest, I don't have a good sense of how involved Romanelli was in all of this. I mean, it's an awkward situation. Like I said, I mean, we do have this onerous law about ballot access here in Pennsylvania. You know, Romanelli wants to be on the ballot. I mean, I've looked into his background, and he legitimately is somebody who has, in the past espoused the views of the Green Party. So he's not a totally phony candidate. I mean, it seems like he's a legitimate Green Party member. You know, he wants to get on the ballot in this U.S. Senate race. Somebody just, you know, shows up with the money and the means to do this. And, you know, I don't know if he knew a lot about where this money was coming from or if he decided just to look the other way. But, you know, clearly, you know, and I should stress that, I mean, what happened here is legal. I mean, it's legal for these conservatives to give money to the Green Party. I mean, it's kind of hypocritical for all these anti-abortion people to give money to a pro-choice party. You know, people like you mentioned, the head of Blackwater USA, the mercenary company, which is making millions of dollars in Iraq, and they're supporting the party that wants to pull, supposedly wants to pull troops out of Iraq immediately. So there's a lot of...
And the former Bill Frist aide, who now lobbies for Kellogg Brown and Root, the Halliburton subsidiary, making a lot of money in Iraq, not to mention the oil giant Chevron.
Right, exactly. So you have all of those people giving money to the Green Party. I mean, it's an incredible thing. Like I said, it's legal, but it's the kind of thing, and you know, this is where journalists come in and campaign finance laws. It may be legal, but voters need to know about this. And I mean, that's what I've been trying to do, writing about this a few times on my blog, Attitude.
We're not able to go back to Michael Berg in Delaware because we lost that studio, and we're switching over to Washington State to talk with a Green Party candidate. But Howie Hawkins, what is your response in such situations like this where the party is manipulated?
Well, I wouldn't have taken the money from those sources. Carl Romanelli should have checked out his sources. I don't know the story on whether he approved receiving that money in order to get onto the ballot. I do know Carl Romanelli. I've met him over the years. He's an anti-war candidate. Casey, the Democrat, is not anti-war, as well as the other issues the reporter mentioned. But there's another story here, and that is that the firm, that Republican-oriented firm, was hired by the Nader campaign in 2004 and apparently the Romanelli campaign this year to help them get signatures. They're a signature-gathering firm, and that's what the money was used for. Some of those signatures were fraudulent, you know, Mickey Mouse, whatever. And then the Democrats challenged that petition, and it's been ruled in court that the whole petition was fraudulent and that Nader in the 2004 case has to pay the Democrats $80,000 for their legal fees, and now Romanelli has to pay an even higher fee. And because once the Democrats brought them to court on that challenge, the other two candidates, because Romanelli was slated with the governor and lieutenant governor candidates, those two Green candidates dropped out. The point was they were intimidated. Another thing about 2004 is that the Democrats hired a Republican law firm that gave lots of pro bono help to challenge Nader's petition in Pennsylvania. So, you know, maybe Romanelli was set up. I do know that, to me, the worst thing is not that they took some money from some bad sources to try to get onto the ballot, but the courts in Pennsylvania are intimidating third-party candidates from even trying to get on a ballot by putting these exorbitant fees on them, to pay the legal fees of the people that challenge them for running. I mean, it makes you think twice about even running for office. How can you deal with a $100,000 fine?
Well, Howie Hawkins, I want to thank you very much for being with us, New York Green Party candidate for Senate. And Will Bunch, thanks for joining us. He's a senior editor at the Philadelphia Daily News and author of the blog Attitude. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. When we come back from break, we'll go to Washington State. Stay with us. Viva by the band Dusseldorf here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Green Party nominee for Senate in Washington State is Aaron Dixon. Last week, Aaron Dixon was arrested at a local television station for entering the lobby and demanding he be included in that station's televised debates between the Democratic Senator Maria Cantwell and Republican Mike McGavick. Aaron Dixon now joins us from a studio in Seattle. We welcome you to Democracy Now!
Hello, Amy.
It's good to have you with us. Well, describe what happened.
Well, on the day of the debate, I and 50 volunteers and supporters from our campaign went down to King 5 TV studios. While the supporters were outside, I saw an opportunity to go in the door where the debate was taking place, and I went in, and I was confronted by several security personnel. At that point, I requested that I be allowed to participate in the debate because I am running for U.S. Senate. They refused, and I asked to speak to a supervisor or someone that was in charge so that I could explain to them why I felt that I should be included in the debate. After being given the runaround for several minutes, they called the police department, and the officer showed up and said that he would have to escort me out. I told him that I refused to leave, and then I was arrested.
And what were you charged with?
Well, I wasn't really charged with anything. They said that they were arresting me for being on the premises without permission.
Because it's private property?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Who owns King 5?
It's owned by a large corporation. It used to be owned by the Bullock family. I'm not quite sure. Belo owns it now. Thank you.
I am looking at the video footage now, and for our radio listeners, you can go on our website and you can watch Aaron Dixon being arrested. But it looks like there were a lot of people outside with signs that say, for example, "Let Dixon debate." Who were the people outside? How many were there?
Well, there are about 50 supporters and volunteers of the Aaron Dixon for U.S. Senate campaign.
And so where does it stand right now? And what were the responses of the Democratic and Republican candidates to you being arrested trying to participate in the debate?
Well, they totally ignored it. They didn't say anything about the incident whatsoever.
Why did you want to participate in the debate?
Well, because I felt that my voice needed to be heard, that there needed to be a different perspective than the perspective of the two parties that we hear from all the time, and that I felt that I should not be excluded merely because our campaign was not able to raise $1 million.
A million dollars?
Yes.
What
that
were
was
the
one of the requirements. That was one of the requirements that
set
you had
by
to
whom?
Have. King TV.
So they're determining who gets heard in this senatorial race.
Yes.
Talk about your background, Aaron Dixon. Why did you get involved in Green Party politics? Where do you come from?
Well, I was a member of the Black Panther Party for 10 years during the late 60s and 70s. And over the past 20 years, I've worked with at-risk youth and gang-involved youth. I've also had the opportunity to travel to South America and participate in the World Social Forum in Brazil and Venezuela. And when I was approached by the Green Party about running for U.S. Senate, running as a political candidate is something that I never wanted to do, never felt that I had any inclination to do, but I felt that it was time in this country that we began to introduce the concept that we have a multi-party system and that we provide the American people with more choices than what we have now, particularly more progressive choices that are delivering a different type of message than the message that we get from the Republican Party and the Democratic Party.
Have you had any contact with the Democratic candidate, with Maria Cantwell, and what has been their response to your Green Party candidacy?
Personally, no, I haven't had any response from her, but we have had responses from people in her campaign that have offered money for me to drop out of the campaign.
What do you mean, offered money? Who offered you money?
Well, there was a candidate, an anti-war candidate named Mark Wilson, and Mark Wilson and I had crossed paths on many occasions. He was running as a Democrat, and he had said in several instances that after the primary that he would throw his support my way. But about a month ago, Mark Wilson joined the Maria Cantwell camp. And shortly after that, he made a call to me personally and asked that if I would be willing to drop out, that they would raise, that there were people in Maria's camp that would raise a lot of money for the nonprofit that I founded.
What is that nonprofit?
It's called Central House. We work with at-risk youth, and we have a transitional housing program.
So they'd throw a fundraiser for you, or they would just raise money for your nonprofit?
Yes, they would raise money for my nonprofit.
Did you consider this?
No, I didn't. No, I didn't consider that at all.
So are you saying they tried to bribe you?
Yeah, I received at least three or four calls from Mr. Wilson and someone else in Maria Cantwell's camp on a regular basis about dropping out.
Why do you think they see you as a threat? How close is the race?
Well, I think because of what happened with Ted Lamont defeating... Ned Lamont, defeating Lieberman. I think that there was some concern that because of Maria Cantwell's support on the war, that that she would possibly be in trouble, and that her Republican challenger, Mike McGavick, seemed to be running a well-organized campaign.
So what are your plans now? Are there any other debates planned? And how are you campaigning for Green Party candidate for Senate in Washington State?
Well, there is another debate scheduled for Maria Cantwell and Mike McGavick in Spokane. I'm not quite sure what we're going to do about that, but we have continued to run our campaign. We just finished a statewide tour, talking to a lot of rural communities. For the next couple of weeks, we're going to concentrate our work in Seattle and outlining areas of Seattle and continue to campaign and work towards getting as many votes as we possibly can.
Well, Aaron Dixon, I want to thank you very much for joining us, Green Party candidate for Senate in Washington State, joining us from a studio in Seattle. In fact, Democracy Now! Is headed to Washington State this weekend. On Friday, I'll be in Olympia, Washington. On Saturday, in Mount Vernon, Washington, also in Bellingham, Washington. You can go to our website, democracynow.org, for details. On Saturday night, I'll be speaking in Vancouver, Canada, and on Sunday, in Victoria, British Columbia, and Canada. Tonight, I'll be at Barnes & Noble at 7 o'clock here in New York City on East 17th Street, the Union Square, Barnes & Noble. Tomorrow night in Jeffersonville, Lock Sheldrake in New York, as we celebrate Community Station WJFF at Sullivan Community College there, as we continue our Breaking the Sound Barrier tour. All tour details at our website, democracynow.org. Special thanks to our remarkable crew here at Democracy Now! Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Berkshire, Fodoka Deuce, John Hamilton, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Richin, Aaron Mate, Jen Utes, Mike DeFilippo, and Nick Marsilio are our engineers. Thanks also to Uri Galed, Angela Alston, to Megan Whitney, Danielle Stramberg-Peshkin, Louis Abuespa, Jillian O'Connor, Tyshawn Black, Jerome Bourgeois. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.